From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com. Governments often like to turn to sin taxes on items such as alcohol and tobacco. Do these taxes represent good public policy? You'll hear expert analysis. Some state lawmakers are angry about an unpublicized office within the Division of Motor Vehicles. It offered driver's licenses to selected government workers while the rest of us waited in line at the DMV. With no race for president, governor, or U.S. Senate on this year's ballot, many observers are focusing on six proposed state constitutional amendments. We'll take a closer look at all six. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
It was a bipartisan moment in the North Carolina General Assembly. In mid-October, lawmakers from both sides of the political aisle joined with Governor Roy Cooper on a nearly $800 million Hurricane Florence disaster relief package. Now, the plan is set to address the immediate needs of those impacted by Florence's torrential rains, mainly in southeast and coastal North Carolina, as well as to attend to long-term recovery and rebuilding plans. The John Locke Foundation's Senior Vice President, Becky Gray, followed all the goings-on very closely, and she's here to give us a sense of what happened in the chamber in mid-October. Becky, welcome back.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
So folks really did put politics aside.
Absolutely.
And came together and tried to do something about the incredible devastation that we saw. What was your sense of it?
A couple things. First of all, yes, bipartisan support. Everybody came together. I mean, there's just no arguing that there are tremendous needs, not only right now, but are going to take probably years to really recover. This isn't a problem for Republicans. This isn't a problem for Democrats. This is a problem for every North Carolinian. And I think we saw that, of course, in the devastated areas. We saw it in Raleigh, on Jones Street. But I think we've seen it across the state with the response that we've had with that. Donna, the thing that struck me the most, and I think it's important to keep this in mind, thank goodness for the bold leadership and the fiscal management that we've seen over the last 8 years, that there was $2 billion set aside. Now, you know, as we've seen on the news, and certainly Carolina Journal has reported on this, the needs are going to far exceed that. But we had that $2 billion cushion, that rainy day fund, and that rainy day came. And you may recall that as the General Assembly was debating about what to do with the revenue surplus that we've seen over the last several budget cycles as our economy is improving, there were many, Governor Roy Cooper was one that said, you know, we ought not be putting that money aside. You know, we ought to be spending it for new programs, for expansion, for more government kind of things. The leadership of the General Assembly said, you know what, it's really important to save that money. $2 billion is the largest that it has ever been in the state of North Carolina. And I think, you know, just imagine, if you would, that we were dealing with this kind of devastation, this kind of need that is there, and we didn't have that $2 billion but had those same needs, we'd be looking at tax increases. We'd be looking at, you know, for these folks in the southern and eastern part of North Carolina trying to rebuild their businesses, trying to come out of this. Can you imagine if their taxes were increased in addition to, you know, what they're going through? So for lots of reasons, the one thing that I just keep in my mind as we look at this is thank goodness for the kind of leadership that we've had. And let me just mention, you know, and you mentioned there were $800 million that was allocated this week. That's in addition to the $56 million that was allocated a couple weeks ago. They have said they're going to continue to look at this. We can expect more money to come out of that rainy day fund because we need it, and this is what it was there for. But I expect that by the end of this, all, if not all, most of that money will go for what we need it for. But then what do we do when the next storm comes?
Are they going to be rebuilding that fund?
Exactly. And so I think that's one thing that I would encourage voters to think about as they go to the polls on in November, you know, early voting, or, you know, as they cast their ballots, to look for leaders who are committed to this kind of fiscal management and understand, because we don't know when the next storm is going to come, but we can rest assured there's going to be another one. There are going to continue to be needs. And just like we needed this rainy day fund, we're going to need the next one and the next one. And we've got to make sure that we have, in my view, that we have the kind of leadership in place that is going to recognize that and make that a priority.
I think one of the reasons they were able to come back for this special session to get this package through so quickly is because they knew that money was sitting there for something like this. And I can recall the debate that you referred to over the past several years, where there was a lot of pressure placed on legislators to go ahead and spend that money rather than saving it. And you had really some strong leadership to stand up and say, look, you know, certainly we could do that, but what happens if the unexpected occurs, as you always know it will, whether it's an economic downturn or tragically something like a hurricane? And so those folks who stood up really, I think, have been proven to have had the leadership abilities to say, I'm not going to give in to the pressure. And there was a lot of it.
There was. Yeah. And that's why I said, I mean, you know, this took bold leadership and it took really strong fiscal management to understand that. I mean, just think about your family budget. You know, when you sit down, you know, there's always a family member. It may be your 6-year old, but you know, there's somebody that says, no, let's not put the money aside. We want to go to Disneyland. We want, you know, we want a pony. You know, we want more stuff. We want more toys. We want, you know, and in some cases, there are certainly legitimate needs, but it's a matter of priorities. And so I think that's the important thing. You know, along with this $2 billion that they have grown this rainy day fund, you know, we've also had the largest teacher pay increases. Teachers have gotten pay increases over the last 5 years. State employees have gotten pay increases. So it's a matter of priorities. And if you're smart and if you're strong and if you have that bold leadership and that ability to say, you know, no to those who want to spend for whatever reason, it's just a matter of priorities. And so again, you know, as we all go to the polls and consider these things, I think it's important to look at the candidates and the leadership that you think is important.
Becky, we mentioned that some of this money that now has been appropriated will go to the more short-term immediate needs. I mean, there are people who don't have houses. There are schools that have mold that have to have something done to them in order to just make them habitable for kids and teachers to come back to, all sorts of things like that. But this is also bringing up some long-term questions, really policy questions about where we go from here, because we know North Carolina is always going to be subject to hurricanes and major storms like this. And there are now some folks who are saying that maybe we need to go out and, for example, dredge the rivers, the creeks in the flood prone areas to make sure that at least we mitigate some of the damage in the future. So there are going to be questions that legislators as well as local officials need to address that are policy issues.
Right, exactly. And, you know, all of those questions, I think the important thing to remember, again, just like, you know, bold, strong, very reasoned leadership is what we need. It would be easy to go in and spend a lot of money on doing some of those things that may or may not have long-term effects. You know, anytime you're trying to fight back Mother Nature, I think you need to be very, very careful.
Right.
We've seen that on our coast with some of the dredging around the ports, some of the, you know, big truckloads of sand that come in to reinforce and re-nourish the beaches. You know, what we're seeing is it really is not as effective as some people might believe. So I think we need to be really careful with that. Something else that I think really needs a close look at, and again, a big policy issue, is our water and sewer systems. You know, our water and sewer systems across North Carolina were built about 50 years ago, and the materials that were used have a lifespan of about 50 years. Well, then you get into the flooding and the erosion and all of the things that we've had in the southern and eastern part of North Carolina. We've got to make sure that the water and sewer is rebuilt in a way. And that's going to take a lot of money, those infrastructure projects. The roads, some of the roads that are continuing to flood, do we rebuild that after every storm, or do we restructure somehow the infrastructure in the way that people get around in that part of the state? And with those considerations, again, whether you've got the schools, whether you've got affordable housing, whether you've got businesses that are back on their feet. It has to be done in such a way that ensures that we have economic growth in those areas and across our state. It may look very different.
We've been talking with Becky Gray. She is Senior Vice President for the John Locke Foundation. Of course, you can read all of her work at carolinajournal.com, also johnlocke.org, and on Twitter.
At Becky Gray, B-E-C-K-I-G-R-A-Y.
Becky, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, friends, rivals, great American presidents. Their ideas still have great value today. You can hear those ideas Monday, November 5th. It's a special living history event in Raleigh. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams come to life in a debate on the future of the United States of America. Taxes, trade, foreign threats. Jefferson and Adams dealt with them all. They'll hash out their differences before a live audience. You can join them. It's Living History, Monday, November 5th, 7 p.m. at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Tickets are $10, $5 for students. Buy tickets online at johnlocke.org. That's johnlocke with an E.org. Or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Many governments assess so-called sin taxes on items such as alcohol and tobacco. Do these taxes represent good public policy? A recent panel discussion tackled that topic. The event was co-hosted by the John Locke Foundation, Western Carolina University's Center for the Study of Free Enterprise, and the Federalist Society. We're interviewing panelists to get their take on the topic. In this segment, we welcome Dr. Todd Nesbitt, Assistant Professor of Economics at Ball State University and co-editor of a book on this very topic titled For Your Own Good, Taxes, Paternalism, and Fiscal Discrimination in the 21st Century. Welcome to the program.
I appreciate you having me on the show.
So first of all, your book tackles this exact topic, sin taxes, what they do, why they're in place, whether they represent good public policy. Tell us what the book is designed to do.
Yeah, so Adam Hoffer and I, we pulled together 25 academic scholars from around the nation who all have a lot of experience working in the tax space. And, you know, it's the book itself is geared toward really trying to explain, number one, why we end up seeing selective taxes as opposed to broader-based, more efficient, economically efficient taxes. And then secondly, really what are some of the secondary unintended consequences that result from these taxes. And then we obviously conclude with some general guidelines, some best practices for a lot of the states and local governments.
You use the term selective taxes, not quite the term sin taxes, but sin taxes would be among these selective taxes.
Yes, absolutely. So the most common selective type of selective tax would be, I think most people would see it as a sin tax. But even cell phone and data charges or taxes would fall under that and haven't quite made it to the sin tax level. But I think that in the future, I think you'll probably see some arguments that in that regard with data plans that are out there.
In general, I get the sense that people who have studied these taxes and looked at them from the vantage point of good versus bad public policy say, this is probably not the right way to go.
No, selective taxes ultimately have led to really poor policy across the board. I've labeled it as lazy public policy in many respects. And so broad-based taxes are certainly much more efficient. Selective taxes, they tend to disadvantage certain parties. There's a lot of the burden of these taxes certainly fall on the poor. And then they ultimately advantage some corporations or some companies compared to some others. And so there's some cronyism involved in the application of these taxes. Politicians generally see them as more politically advantageous, mainly because if there's some need for raising revenue, whether it be due to an increase in expenditures or a decrease in intergovernmental grants from the federal level, there's that revenue need. but they could fund it either through broad-based that apply increase in taxes on all their constituents, or you can selectively tax some small segment of your constituents. Only about 15% of the population now smoke. That's an easy target at this point. And they can put a nice spin on it that says, oh, well, we're doing this to improve health as well.
We are chatting with Dr. Todd Nesbitt, assistant professor of economics at Ball State University, and as we mentioned, also co-editor of a book on this topic of selective taxes or sin taxes. It's called For Your Own Good, Taxes, Paternalism, and Fiscal Discrimination in the 21st Century. Some people are going to be listening to us and they're going to say, wait a minute, people who smoke, there's no reason why we shouldn't just put an extra tax on those cigarettes, or people who drink alcohol. You know, they're choosing to do these things. They don't have to do these things. Why not just put some extra taxation on that? From the vantage point of someone looking at good tax policy, why is that not the right way to focus on this?
Yeah, so I think that typically when we've talked about sin taxes historically, it's been more of correcting for actions that have – like that an individual or a group of individuals take that tend to have some cost side cost on to other people unaffiliated with that action itself. These are – in the economics lingo, this would be an externality problem. And now we're starting to see with cigarettes, it used to be – the argument used to be, oh, secondhand smoke. So there was that external cost. Now the focus is more – has become more on – it's internality. So cost on myself that if I happen to smoke, well, I'm causing damage to myself, reducing my own health, and I'm just not aware enough of it or knowledgeable enough, to actually take the correct action. And, you know, I think that there's potentially some good argument to say, hey, maybe we should try to help fellow citizens be more healthy. But the bigger question is, should we do that through a stick? So punishing them for this consumption, or trying to more lead it with lead their decision making more with a carrot rather than that stick. And so try to have these educational campaigns, even have some type of program where we reward them for smoking cessation.
You work at Ball State University in the Midwest. Why come down to North Carolina and participate with a group and your peers in a presentation designed for North Carolinians? Is this a state that could definitely learn some lessons here?
Yeah, North Carolina is a really interesting case, I think, mainly because if you look at a lot of the business climate indices that exist out there, the Tax Foundation just recently put out the 2019 State Tax Business Climate Index. North Carolina ranks number 12. This is really quite good. Top to roughly 20% of the nation. But that's with the business climate. And if you look at in our book, we have a paternalism index that's state-based. North Carolina ranks 33rd. And so certainly there's a lot of room for improvement in the use of taxes, selective taxes. The state doesn't do too bad. They're roughly 21, 22 in that index. So certainly on the better half of the group. But they really tend to struggle with bans. So really that paternalist nature, so trying to discourage certain actions and doing so through public policy. And so a lot of individual freedoms are being really diminished mainly through some of these tax policy and bans. A ban is essentially almost, you can interpret it as like an infinite selective tax. And so it falls into the same line of literature as well.
If people are interested in targeting these things like alcohol consumption or cigarette use, what's a good way to attack this policy-wise that doesn't involve the selective taxation that you see as such a problem?
Yeah, that's a difficult one, certainly, because I think it we could try to rely on, as I think we used to some time ago, rely on a lot of nonprofits to pick up that role. However, if we want to do it through public policy, there's certainly going to need to be some form of tax revenue to fund various programs. And so it's really, I think, that based on some of our research that's presented in the book, I think it's more of, well, if we want to reduce cigarette smoking, tie or earmark the tax source that links directly with the need. So if there's more people smoking, there's a greater need potentially then for smoking cessation programs that needs more revenue. However, if we then tax cigarettes and earmark that directly for those that expenditure, we see that more smoking leads to more revenue for cessation programs, and it's responding directly to the need.
Well, very interesting topic. And one of the people who is right on the mark on these issues is the co-editor of the book, For Your Own Good, Taxes, Paternalism, and Fiscal Discrimination in the 21st Century. He is Dr. Todd Nesbitt, Assistant Professor of Economics at Ball State University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, friends, rivals, great American presidents. Their ideas still have great value today. You can hear those ideas Monday, November 5th. It's a special living history event in Raleigh. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams come to life in a debate on the future of the United States of America. Taxes, trade, foreign threats. Jefferson and Adams dealt with them all. They'll hash out their differences before a live audience. You can join them. It's Living History, Monday, November 5th, 7 p.m. at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Tickets are $10, $5 for students. Buy tickets online at johnlock.org. That's johnlock with an E.org. Or call 1-866-JLF-INFO.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some lawmakers are angry about a special office within the State Division of Motor Vehicles. It provided driver's licenses for selected state employees. Senator Tommy Tucker wants answers.
This DMV quick stop convenience store that they run separately from the main DMV. And we talk about trust and integrity. I don't understand. The press did a great job reporting on this. They even asked DMV, did a special office exist in DMV? And he said no. And then we find out that it does for certain privileged state officials, those that don't have time to wait in line. And I would ask that this committee look at why that office was established, if it's still going on, and how do we explain as politicians and public servants that we have a privilege to get our license and IDs in a 20-minute quick stop store at DMV that doesn't exist for the general public where they stand in line. I had a father call me probably 2 weeks ago, and John was concerned about his daughter being able to get a license pretty quickly. She was going off to school. And we just basically told him we couldn't help him in that she'd have to stand in line like everybody else and just like the rest of us do. You know, Senator Berger, how much it irks me to have people of privilege be able to get out in front of the rest of us.
Senate Leader Phil Berger assured Tucker his complaints would not go unnoticed.
I think your points are well taken. I am certain that it is something that we haven't heard last about, and the commission, as well as individual members, I'm sure, will be continuing to ask questions.
Representative Nelson Dollar weighed in. Beyond the special DMV office, he wants to know why everyone else is facing such long lines for licenses.
I know for my constituents, we've got just massive lines out there. And I made some inquiries. I know that the central staff here at the General Assembly has been working overtime to get information, and there was some lag in getting that information. I think, at least I hope, they have the data now that they had been seeking. I think folks want to know why suddenly we've got all of these lines. I do think this is an issue that's affecting so many people, and we need to get to the bottom of it.
You've been listening to state lawmakers' complaints about issues related to North Carolina driver's licenses. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Many governments assess so-called sin taxes on items such as alcohol and tobacco. Do these taxes represent good public policy? A recent panel discussion tackled that topic. The event was co-hosted by the John Locke Foundation, Western Carolina University's Center for the Study of Free Enterprise, and the Federalist Society. And we're interviewing panelists to get their take on this issue and related topics. In this segment, we welcome Dr. Craig Depkin, professor of economics at UNC Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You are an author of one of the chapters in a book that's on this subject, For Your Own Good, Taxes, Paternalism, and Fiscal Discrimination in the 21st Century. And your chapter deals not necessarily so much with sin taxes per se, whether they're good or not, but more the whole idea of subsidies of sports stadiums and the selective taxes used to deal with that. Is that correct?
Correct, right.
So tell us a little bit about these sports stadiums and how taxation fits in with them.
Well, most of us would be familiar with the publicly funded stadiums. Historically, this was very common that a city would build a stadium hosting any number of events. Could be professional sports, motocross, soccer, things like that. Over the past 25, 30 years, stadiums have become much more selective and much more specialized. So we have single-purpose stadiums instead of multi-purpose stadiums. And at the same time, the expenditure on these stadiums has increased dramatically. So a stadium that used to cost $30 million back in the 60s now would cost almost $1 billion. And some of that is because of construction costs and labor unions, whatnot. That's fine. But a lot of it is because of the fancy suites and other opening roofs and things like that. So what we talk about in our chapter is how are these stadiums going to be financed? So there's two choices. One would be that it would be financed by the team owner or by the league, some private entity, or the public will provide money for this. Over the past, say, 25, 30 years, the public has provided substantial amounts, maybe more than $1 billion towards stadium construction across the country. And how do these particular expenditures financed? And so there are plenty of ways that economists could talk about how we would finance these stadiums, but we know what the politicians do. They choose sales taxes. They might choose hotel taxes, choose car rental taxes. And the idea here is that with the sales tax is a broad base, and so the sales tax doesn't have to be very high. But because everybody's being charged a quarter of a penny every time, eventually the stadium will be paid for. When it comes to the hotel taxes and car rental taxes, the typical story is that, well, those are outsiders that are coming in, and we'll tax those people that come in for tourism, and either for the events or for other reasons that they're coming in. And what we talk about in our chapter is that this is fine. You can charge a hotel tax, but the question is who's actually paying that tax, not the individual who has the tax paid on their credit card or whatever, but who's actually bearing the burden of that tax. And if you think about a tax that is actually binding so that people change their behaviors, then in the case of a hotel tax, fewer hotel rooms would be rented out because the tax has increased the cost of a hotel room. Maybe not the person who's coming to, say, Charlotte for a Panthers game, you know, they're going to come regardless. But there might be other decision makers who say, well, we could have our conference, say we're the local dentist association, we could have a conference here in Charlotte, but we could also have it in Asheville instead. And Asheville doesn't have the same tax as Charlotte. So I'll move the conference from Charlotte to Asheville. That means fewer rooms were rented in Charlotte because of this tax. Now, it's hard to tell because we didn't see that, right? They didn't show up in Charlotte, so we didn't know that this happened. And it's probably not advertised in the paper that the dentists are not coming to Charlotte. But the real problem is that from the economist's point of view is that if there are fewer rooms being rented in Charlotte or any other city that imposes these taxes, then that means there are fewer people going to be hired by hotel owners, right? So there are fewer maid services, there are fewer restaurant employees. And so who bears the burden of this tax? I mean, somebody paid it, of course, but the burden could be local employers, right? Employees. It could be local suppliers, right? People who package soap for hotels. I mean, there are fewer rooms being rented. We need fewer bars of soap. And so what we talk about in our chapter is that incidence of these taxes. It's very difficult to actually measure. It's easier to kind of theoretical about this, but what we are worried about is that the incidence of these taxes don't fall on the people that are advertised. Take a car rental tax. Charlotte might not be a great example, but in Arlington, Texas, they put a car rental tax. But in Arlington, most of the cars that are being rented are by locals. The main car rental place would be at the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, which is not in Arlington, Texas. So somebody has their car under repair and they need to rent a car for a week or a few days. That's a local that's renting the car. So the car rental tax was advertised as being only forced on the outsider, the person who comes in and is a tourist and then is going to pay the tax. But it could be that the locals are paying the tax. Could be the same thing with the hotel situation. So you have a family reunion, so all your family is coming in. So are those are the outsiders you wanted to tax? You really wanted to tax the person that was coming in for the Panthers game or for a baseball game. And instead, we're kind of imposing these taxes on individuals who we weren't really advertised as bearing the incident. So that's really the discussion we come up with, is that we could choose some amount of public money to pay for the stadiums. And then the question is, how do we go about doing that in a way that's transparent, but also puts the burden of the cost on those who are receiving the benefits of this? And so that's the second part of our chapter talks about if we're going to finance a stadium, who should actually pay for it? And again, kind of think about it commonsensically, maybe the people that are getting a lot of benefit from that stadium should pay for it. So that might be the fans that go and visit the stadium, go to the games. Maybe they should pay a tax on the tickets, or they should pay personal seat licenses finance the stadium, as opposed to shoving it on people that maybe couldn't afford to go to the games. Or frankly, if you don't like football or you don't like the sport that's being played in that stadium, why are you being forced to pay for it? So that's kind of the story in our chapter, yeah.
We are chatting with Dr. Craig Depkin, professor of economics at UNC Charlotte. And as I listened to you discussing how this tax was playing out, I thought of the common term we hear in economics of the law of unintended consequences, that you think you're targeting one group, you actually end up hurting a whole other group, including the people who tend to get hurt more by taxation.
Very much. And in our story, in our chapter, we talk about tax incidents. It's typically talked about between buyers and sellers. So there's a sales tax on some particular good, who's going to bear the brunt of that tax? Is it the buyer or the seller? And what we're trying to get at is that it's actually much more nuanced than that, because there's lots of dimensions in which people could be bearing costs of a tax or any other policy. So it could be that there's a sales tax locally. I have a car, so I can try to drive away from that tax. I could go to the next county over and buy my goods and services at another county where I don't pay that tax. But if I don't have a car, then I can't avoid this. Maybe it could be a wealth issue, that is rich versus poor, but it could be time of purchase. I have to buy this today because I have an emergency, but you know, somebody else is buying 6 months from now, so they have plenty of opportunity to find a substitute. So tax incentives typically, like in a principles of microeconomics course, would be talked this, in a very simplistic way, but we're trying to be more nuanced and say that, just as you were saying, that the tax that you're imposing on one group of people could actually be borne by another group of people that you didn't see coming. And Frederick Bastiat, you know, famously said there's a seen and the unseen. And so seeing who pays the tax, so okay, pay a tax at the hotel, I get it. There's a credit card swipe. That person paid the tax in dollar terms, but we don't know who actually bears the cost. And that's a little, again, a more nuanced question. And one that, especially when we talk about the stadium finances, because the numbers are so large. I mean, you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars spread over 30 years, that these effects are not small and not temporary. They can be around for quite some time.
Well, it's certainly a very interesting angle to this whole idea of the specialized taxes, targeted taxes, sin taxes. And the person we've been speaking with and one of the authors of a chapter in the book For Your Own Good is Dr. Craig Depkin, professor of economics at UNC Charlotte. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, friends, rivals, great American presidents, their ideas still have great value today. You can hear those ideas Monday, November 5th. It's a special living history event in Raleigh. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams come to life in a debate on the future of the United States of America. Taxes, trade, foreign threats. Jefferson and Adams dealt with them all. They'll hash out their differences before a live audience. You can join them. It's Living History, Monday, November 5th, 7 p.m. at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Tickets are $10, $5 for students. Buy tickets online at johnlock.org. That's johnlock with an E.org. Or call 1-866-JLF-INFO.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Early voting is underway across North Carolina, with the official election day just around the corner on November 6th. Now, voters will be casting ballots for a variety of offices, including a seat on the North Carolina Supreme Court, three seats on the North Carolina Court of Appeals, members of U.S. Congress, and of course, members of the North Carolina General Assembly. But there are also six additional items up for a yes or no vote. They are amendments to the North Carolina Constitution, and they have created, in some cases, quite a battle among the advocates for or against these particular ideas. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Carolina Journal following all of this information quite closely. Rick's here to help us make sense of it all. Welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, let's name the six constitutional amendments, just so everybody understands the six that they will be voting on.
Right. One of them would enshrine in the Constitution the right to hunt and fish, which is something that supporters say is necessary to protect those rights from being eroded through legislation. Opponents say really isn't necessary. That's sort of the general gist of that. A second amendment would cap the current state income tax rate at 7%. It would actually reduce the cap that's now in the Constitution. The cap of the Constitution right now is 10%. This would reduce it to 7%. The General Assembly could never increase the tax rate, income tax rate, above 7%. That would actually constitute a major tax increase over what we have now. But anyway, supporters say this would keep taxes in check. Opponents say this is simply a way to prevent government from doing what it needs to do, or would cause the General Assembly to have to rely on other forms of taxation if it wanted to spend more. Third Amendment deals with voter ID, a requirement that people provide a government-issued photo ID when they vote. It's a long-standing controversy that's been through both federal and state courts. The arguments are fairly straightforward. The proponents say that that ID is necessary to protect the integrity of elections. Opponents say this could be used as a way to disenfranchise voters who don't have IDs.
We also have victim rights on
yes,
the ballot.
And that's a rather it's an interesting amendment in that it talks about providing crime victims and people who were sort of ancillary to crime victims, like family members, more access to the courts and the judicial process. Again, supporters say this is something to sort of level the playing field for the victims versus offenders. Opponents are saying that this is simply a way to gum up the process a little more and make the dispensation of justice slower.
Rick, then the final two amendments are getting all sorts of attention, and both of them relate to the authority between the General Assembly and the governor's office. Tell us about those.
The first one would reconstitute the State Board of Elections and Ethics Enforcement, which was combined. The Ethics Commission and the State Board of Elections were combined several years ago by the General Assembly. This would enshrine them in the Constitution as agencies that were equally appointed between members of the Republicans and Democrats in the General Assembly. Basically, they would nominate members for an 8-member state board. The governor would choose among those slate of nominees.
Okay. And then judicial vacancies?
Yes. This would change the current system by which the governor fills vacancies that appear on judicial posts all across the realm from Supreme Court all the way down to local judges. And this would place that most of that vacancy appointment process in the hands of a panel that would then forward nominations to the governor based on the recommendations of that panel. It's called merit-based selection, although that's a bit of not necessarily an accurate description, because there's really nothing merit-based about it. It's just simply that rather than having the governor appoint them, this panel would appoint them.
And that is the crux of some interesting debate that has gone on. First of all, we should say that there is one particular effort underway called Nix All Six.
Right.
Those are people who don't want voters to pass any of these
yes.
amendments. But then these last two regarding kind of the tug of war of power between mm-hmm. the governor's seat. And again, we're not talking about the person who occupies the governor's office, which happens to be Roy Cooper right now, but the power of that office versus the power of the General Assembly. And we've had former North Carolina governors among those who have gotten involved in the discussion
right.
here.
Right. I guess the first thing to say about any of these discussions about the balance of power between the General Assembly, the governor, and the courts is that the way our Constitution is written, the legislative branch is the most powerful of the three. In many cases, the judiciary and the executive branches have whatever power the General Assembly decides to give it, unless those powers are described in the Constitution itself. So that's the first thing a lot of people need to remember. We have a separation of powers principle, but we don't have a balance of power, unlike the federal system. So the argument is over whether or not the executive branch has enough power to actually execute the laws. And so with the issue of the Board of Elections and the Board of Elections and Ethics Enforcement, as it will be called, the issue here is whether or not the governor has enough authority to appoint members to, in effect, execute the laws. And that's why the five living former governors have all come out against it, because they said the General Assembly is simply taking the governor's power away to appoint the people he or she prefers to sit in these positions. And the argument that the General Assembly has made in putting this amendment on the ballot is that this process should be something that is under the General Assembly's purview and actually is being handled by the majority and minority party in each chamber of the General Assembly, each of whom will submit nominations. So Democrats and Republicans will each have the opportunity to nominate a slate of candidates, and the governor will choose from that slate. So the governor really ultimately has the choice, the five former governors are saying, well, no, no, we don't have the choice. We're told you can pick anybody you want as long as it's among these eight people.
Yeah.
So that, and that's the crux of the argument right
now.
Now,
what makes this particularly interesting is that just a few days ago, we also had a court ruling related to this issue.
Yes, that's right. The three-judge panel that's been looking at the constitutionality of the current Board of Elections, and which is now divided between four Democratic appointees, four Republican appointees, and one unaffiliated member who is appointed by the board. So it's a 4-4-1 split right now. The judges ruled that that panel itself was unconstitutional, that the Board of Elections, as it currently is currently constituted, does not meet the standard of separation of powers. It does not allow the governor freedom to appoint the people that he or she chooses. But what it did was it said that the board itself will stay in place until this election is over so that it wouldn't cause chaos.
Okay, so then we run up to the election. Let's say that voters say, yes, they passed the constitutional amendment. Does that render this court ruling moot?
Pretty much, yeah, it does. Because okay. Now then the Board of Elections will be in the Constitution itself.
Okay,
so there's nothing to do about it.
What happens if voters say no? We don't want to pass this.
If voters say no, then the court battle continues. Probably what happens is that the Board of Elections will continue to stay and remain in some fashion until the General Assembly comes up with yet another one, which may be the fourth or fifth since 2016 we've had.
And lastly, Rick, there's been some interesting conversation around this judicial vacancies amendment as well.
Right. Americans for Prosperity, which is a free market grassroots organization, has come out against this particular amendment. And the reason that they stated for it basically is that there's a way in the amendment that if a vacancy comes open early in the term of a General Assembly, that the appointee, who would not be appointed by the governor, would be able to sit for almost 4 years without facing election again. And so that's the crux of that argument.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.